At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You can't fire me. I quit. Well, me and 4 million of my closest friends. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, the 12th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Okay, so how is this for a macroeconomic sign of these times? Almost 3% of the entire American workforce, that's 4.3 million people, they quit in August. They just up and left their jobs. That's according to the monthly JOLTS report that the Labor Department released this morning. Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey is what that stands for. Now, who's quitting and what does it all mean? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
This report shows a record number of people quitting in sectors like accommodations and food services, government speak for hotels and restaurants, and high numbers dropping out in healthcare and manufacturing. Some are leaving for better wages elsewhere. Others have retired early. Holly Wade at the National Federation of Independent Business says there's lots of competition for workers because 5 million people still haven't returned to the labor force.
It's still working out childcare disruption issues, school disruption issues, and also for those navigating what their next job will be.
Digging in on that school disruption part, lots of people are quitting there, too. Almost 25,000 people quit in state and government education in August. Nicola Suarez is president of Kelly Education, a division of staffing firm Kelly Services. She says things are especially bad when it comes to experienced educators, like school principals.
I mean, the annual turnover rate that's being forecasted right now is about 42% of those people leaving. It's an alarming exodus, if you will, of educational talent.
And one reason for that? Parents' behavior. Ron Nazoe runs the National Association of Secondary School Principals. He says some of his members are getting threatened on social media, stalked at home, and worse. Plus, those administrators are struggling with hiring themselves.
The challenge is now broader because schools can't find bus drivers, cafeteria workers, you know, office staff, substitute teachers, teachers.
And with how some people are acting just now, it's a little hard to recruit. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, kind of sluggish all day, actually, kind of a fade at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hot on the heels of that JOLTS report came the regular monthly Small Business Economic Trends survey this morning from the National Federation of Independent Business. Less optimistic than they've been since March is the headline, thanks in no small part to those hiring challenges that Kimberly was just talking about, and, of course, the lack of supply in the supply chain. We've got our own thing we do, though, when we want to know what small business owners are thinking. We call them up. Christina Stemble is the founder and CEO of a direct-to-consumer flower company. It's called Farm Girl Flowers. Christina, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Kai. So feels like it's been about 10 years.
I know, but really only like 10 months, actually.
Yeah.
How was your spring, summer, and early fall?
It was interesting. It's been a challenging year. I feel like I'm always saying the same story.
Interesting is not good. That's what happened.
Yeah, so I think we talked last time right before Valentine's Day, and like a lot of direct-to-consumer brands that ship a lot of product, we had almost 50% of our Valentine's Day packages not delivered on time. So it was hard to recover from. We lost about $5.5 million from the shipping, our shipping partners.
Okay, wait. Hold on, because it's one thing for like a dishwasher or like a bar of soap to not show up. If flowers get delayed, what do you do? You got to like redo the whole thing?
Yeah. With perishability, it just adds a whole other element to it, which is what led to the $5.5 million loss. So that kind of started the year off on a not great note. Sales were still really good at the beginning of the year. I think when we talked last year as well, remember when I was like, sales were great because we're in the gifting space. And so we had 100% growth year over year last year, which was like physically hard. And, you know, we thought that, you know, COVID would be over like everybody this year.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, and it's still not, which has, you know, been really challenging. So this year's actually been way harder than last year, which is just really, it was really surprising to us.
Do you think that's because people now can sort of go out and actually spend money on doing things instead of buying things and sending flowers?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, and I don't blame them. I mean, people want to spend time with their loved ones now and not send gifts to them. And so, you know, as soon as the vaccines were really available in mid-April, we saw our sales soften, like a lot of companies, like almost every company. And we'd built an infrastructure for 100% growth numbers from last year. And we then needed to right size the business for where the sales were. And that
wait, hang on, right, right. Sorry to interrupt. Right size means smaller. Never means bigger, right?
Yeah, we had to make it smaller. We had to, you know, no company wants to say no to growth, but there is another side to that. And growth at 100% growth is really hard to support when that goes away. How do you support the infrastructure that you just built for that? So we actually had to lay off a significant portion of our company this year, or we would have gone out of business and not made it.
All right, so let me go sideways a little bit here. You kind of sound like you're going a million miles an hour, and I can't like in this interview right now, and I can't decide whether that's because you've had a crazy morning or because that's the way you have to be to keep this business going right now.
Yeah, I probably am always like that a little bit. You know, there's the only thing I'm certain of is that there's going to be a lot more uncertainty, and that's hard. You know, when you can't plan for, you know, things that could essentially take you out of business, it's very daunting, right? And probably makes me sound a little crazed. And, I'm not. I'm actually really optimistic for the future now, but also cautious because, you know, a lot of what happened this year, I couldn't control. And when you can't control things, that probably makes you feel a little bit out of just, I don't know, a little bit crazed, I guess, to your point.
Yeah. Well, all right. So if you're optimistic, I'm going to imagine you're past that we're going to go out of business and we're actually going to make it thing. So in a year, how are you going to be doing? Or do you just not know? Is that a ridiculous question?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I'm hoping that next time we talk, I'm like, things are great, finally. You know what I mean? I hope I have that conversation with you at some point. Right now I am very proud of my team though, because you know, we made the changes very quickly this year. And if we hadn't, we wouldn't be here. You know, I'd be here talking to you about how I lost my business because of, you know, when I thought COVID was over and it wasn't, you know, Valentine's Day next year that we're looking to right now that we're actually doing a photo shoot today for, we're taking less risks. We're, you know, it's on a Monday, which is the worst day of the week. Like, can we take a $10 million risk? No, we learned that from last February. It almost took us out of business. So we're just going to leave money on the table this year to lessen our risk so we can make sure that we're here.
It's the smart thing to do to leave that money on the table, but does it kind of kill you a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. It kills my soul, to know that we could do it, especially when sales are soft right now and know that the times of year that we can get it, we can't. Yeah. It kills my soul, definitely.
Christina Stemble, she is the founder, also the CEO of Farm Girl Flowers. Christina, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you soon. It will not be when you go out of business, by the way. That's not going to happen.
Thank you. Right. I do know that we're resilient, and that gives me a lot of hope.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Bye-bye. Kai.
Wendy's, the home of the frosty and four-cornered burger patties, announced a deal today that caught our eye. The fast food chain is partnering with Google Cloud, yes, Google, to transform the drive-thru experience as you know it, as in voice recognition software that takes your order directly to cooks, thus avoiding the whole shouting at the drive-thru menu thing, which is always weird. Also, AI that can politely predict when you might want your next Baconator combo. It's all part of how the pandemic has led to an even stronger relationship between technology and fast food, as Marketplace's Matt Levin explains.
Quincy McClendon hits the drive-thru at this Sacramento-area Wendy's about twice a week for breakfast. He's a big fan of the sausage croissant combo, but he wants it a certain way.
No egg. Well done on the sausage.
Hey, and what drink?
Orange juice.
No egg, well done on the sausage. McClendon says he's never had much of a problem with this order. But imagine a world where Wendy's knew McClendon didn't want egg just by looking at him. Eric Gonzalez is an analyst at KeyBank, which does provide investment banking services to Wendy's. He says data collection is kind of where the industry is headed, using tech to predict drive-thru habits.
They know your license plate number, or they have your facial recognition, so your previous orders are all loaded into the algorithm.
To be clear, none of those are things that Wendy's or Google has talked about yet, but Gonzalez says they already know what you want and when.
You know, they say, well, this guy comes at 2:30 in the morning every Friday night. Maybe he wants the same thing he had last week.
Wendy's and other fast food chains are trying out new tech for more pressing reasons, the labor shortage. Daron Acemoglu is an economist at MIT. He says consumers may be happier with a speedier drive-through, but it may come with a cost.
Over the last four decades, we have been investing more and more in automation technologies, and that has been associated with much greater inequality.
In 5 years, Acemoglu doesn't think Wendy's will have anyone tending the drive-through. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People thought it was absolutely insane.
You got to take risks sometimes, though, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials down 117 points today, 0.3%, 34,378. The NASDAQ down 20, about a 0.1%, 14,465. The S&P 500 down 10, about 0.2%, 43.50. Matt Levin told us the Wendy's Google story. Wendy's down 1% today. Alphabet, Google's parent company, fell 1.7%. Put that in your facial recognition software, huh? McDonald's, which tested automated drive-thru this summer, sank 0.8%. Kimberly was telling us about Jolts and all that. Marriott, up 0.4% today. Hyatt Hotels, up 1.7%. Bonds rose, built on the 10-year T-note, down to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The pressures on Chinese kids, as our Shanghai correspondent Jennifer Pack has been reporting for years now, is intense. There are family pressures and academic pressures as well. And as we told you, this summer, the Chinese government issued some new regulations designed to lessen those academic pressures, a bit anyway. And they're doing it in part by restricting how much private tutoring there can be. And in the process, the Chinese government has kind of pulled the legs out from under a multi-billion dollar tutoring industry. But it's not just executives and investors who've lost out. There are tens of thousands of American and Canadian teachers of English as a second language are in kind of a limbo, too. Here's Jennifer with that story.
Hillary Ross from Minnesota has been traveling around the world. I've reached her in Peru. And she says she funds this by teaching English online to children in China. Until recently, she was with the Chinese platform GoGoKid.
I liked what I had read about GoGoKid. I received an offer that was better than I had received at other companies.
In late July, China's government issued a policy to rein in academic tutoring, which, among other things, forbids the hiring of teachers based outside China. Days later, Ross had a message pop up on her screen.
Like, starting tomorrow, there will be no more classes. And so I had no way to communicate with kids that I had taught and become close to for well over a year.
Somehow, another Chinese firm, VIP Kid, which hires only American and Canadian teachers, is still in business. This five-year-old takes two VIP Kid online classes a week. Her mom, Zhang Ming, says she's desperate to keep the lessons going.
Existing students can still take courses if they bought them before August 9th, so we paid for another 500 lessons.
That costs $12,000, almost the average yearly salary for her county in the eastern Chinese province of Shandong. It's worth it, she says, because the lessons are fun.
Sometimes my daughter puts her foot on the screen, which isn't polite, but the American teacher will either pinch her nose or say the foot smells good. My daughter has a lot of fun learning.
She has made tremendous progress.
That's the daughter's tutor, teacher Kristen. Zhang Ming says parents get only first names to prevent private contact. But we tracked down teacher Kristen Peel, in North Carolina, where it is 12 hours behind China.
For me, my VIP Kid income means that I can work while my children are sleeping, and then I can still be a mom for them during the day.
And when the policy says the aim is to reduce stress on students, she gets it. But why target only foreign teachers based abroad? Here's VIP Kid teacher and a business coach for online teaching, Tim Gascoigne.
There's a real desire for China to be more nationalistic and to have more of their own curriculum and to be more closed off.
What's lost, say teachers, are real connections. Here are teachers Nicole Eastman in Texas and Tina Delgado in Utah on some of their most memorable students.
So I was like, Jasper, say thank you, Mom, for making me dinner. And he said, thank you, Mom, for making me dinner. And she just lit up.
And as soon as that song pops up and he starts moving and doing all this stuff. And he makes me so happy. And the thought of not seeing him or so many others, it saddens me.
There's no telling how long they'll last on VIP Kid. ESL tutor Theodore Anastapulo doesn't like the uncertainty and has quit teaching. It's a shame, he says. He enjoyed learning about Chinese culture from his students.
Anytime we can have reciprocal cultural exchange based off of language, it will do much to diminish the tensions between our two countries. And to take this away, it leaves me questioning the commitment of the Chinese government easing frosty relationships with the United States.
Meantime, some Chinese parents have reached out to their tutors for one-on-one lessons. But teachers beware. Again, online teaching coach Tim Gascoigne.
They have a lot of things to think about. Main one being, what am I going to teach and how am I going to get paid?
Because it's hard to get money in and out of China. And instead of Venmo, Facebook, TikTok, all blocked in China, Chinese parents use Alipay, WeChat, and Douyin. It's challenging. That's why teachers like Hillary Ross in Peru haven't reconnected with many former students.
The sad reality is that there's no way for me to spread the message within China that we're there waiting for them to find us.
If by chance her former students can hop over the Great Firewall and hear this program, get in touch, she says. Teacher Hillary is still looking for you. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
With the caveat that, please, you've got to consult your own financial advisor. A not terrible rule to follow when thinking about what to do with your investments is to do the least you possibly can. Pick your investments and let them grow over time. It's that pick your investments thing, though, that can get tricky. And that gets us to Robin Wigglesworth's new book. It's called Trillions. It's about the birth of the index fund and the changes those funds brought to finance, especially the then radical idea of passive investing.
People thought it was absolutely insane. I mean, the guy that founded Fidelity famously said, who wants to be operated on by a mediocre surgeon, right? Everybody wants to be the best. So the idea of starting a fund that just strives for mediocrity just sounded preposterous. And they were either laughed at or figuratively spat upon.
What was the disruption? What was the innovation in an index fund?
Well, fundamentally, they realized that a lot of human investors, active managers, as they're often called, do a really cruddy job. On average, they actually do worse than the market after the costs of, you know, their salaries and all the research they do. And people didn't really kind of understand this until the 60s, when you suddenly had computers that could actually crunch the numbers. And that was where the index fund sprung out of.
We look back now, and of course, we know all this stuff. Did it take a while for the idea of index funds to catch on?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that was actually started by big pension funds because they had all the numbers and they could kind of see something was amiss. But for ordinary investors, it took people like Jack Bogle to really bring what was an open secret in the big investor world into the ordinary investor world.
Yeah, Bogle's the name we all know. I wonder if is there someone you can point to and say, this is the father of the index fund? Because, of course, they were all men.
Yes. No, they were all fathers at the time. Yes, there is one guy above all. That's John Mack McQuown. He was a former farmhand from Illinois, insanely stubborn and headstrong, ended up on Wall Street, but he was one of the first people that learned how to code. So he ended up giving a speech to the chairman of Wells Fargo at the time, and Ransom Cook, he hired Mack. And Mack was the guy that managed to push through eventually the first ever index fund in 1971.
If Mack McQuown came back today and looked around Wall Street, would he recognize index funds? Because they've changed, right? There's cornucopia is not an overstatement of the kinds of funds you can invest in this genre.
It's a good point, actually. I mean, market has evolved dramatically. I should stress that Mack McQuown is still actually with us. A lot of the other early pioneers have sadly passed away. I think essentially he just loves innovation. Like some of these people, for them, innovation became their raison d'etre. Other people, including Jack Bogle, certainly were worried about where we were heading as they sort of shuffled off their mortal coil.
Well, so since you bring it up, let me talk about financial innovation for a second, because as you know, 12, 13 years ago, the entire global economy almost came a crapper because of innovation on Wall Street, synthetic CDOs and collateralized debt obligations. Innovation in finance does not always turn out as well as index funds do.
No, exactly. And that's a great point. I mean, I make it all the time that, you know, the financial crisis showed that even if finance doesn't care, you don't care about finance. Finance does and care about you and it affects you profoundly. And index funds is one of those rare examples of an actually beneficial financial innovation that has saved millions of Americans hundreds of billions of dollars and trillions indirectly. But because all positive innovation also has negative side effects, we can kind of start seeing the contours of downsides to this revolution in the early 60s and 70s.
Well, give a little bit. I mean, what are the not greats about this?
Well, one of the things is just people can shovel any old crap into an index fund and say, oh, this is a great thing to sell. So humans, we're great at taking great ideas and overdoing them. Mm. And more broadly speaking, it's leading to this massive concentration of economic and financial power in just a few hands. And that's the one thing I do think bears monitoring.
None of my business, but are you an index fund guy in your own life, or do you actively trade your stocks?
No, I definitely don't trade. I talk to some of the smartest people in the world, and they get humbled by the markets all the time. So I think the vast majority of people should stick to boring index funds, and you'll actually do way better than your neighbors and your day trading peers in the long run.
And you read this book and you know where it all came from. Robin Wigglesworth, he's a journalist at the Financial Times. Also, he's got a new book out. It's called Trillions, How a Band of Wall Street Renegades Invented the Index Fund and Changed Finance Forever. Mr. Wigglesworth, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me on.
This final note on the way out from Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic. He was speaking at an event organized by the Peterson Institute for International Economics today.
Now, you'll notice that I brought a prop to the lectern. And in case you can't see it clearly, it's a jar with the word transitory written on it. Over the past few months, this has become something of a swear word to my staff and me. Say the word transitory, and you have to put a dollar in the jar.
Number one, you got to love a Fed official with a sense of humor, right? Number two, Bostic wound up putting $3 in the jar during the course of his speech. And number three, the CPI comes out tomorrow. Inflation, transitory or not, and I'm not putting a buck in the jar. Anyway, inflation at the consumer level. All right, we are going, but here is your moment of economic context in which Jay Powell has actually, it turns out, been doing us a favor. The Federal Reserve tracks the understandability. Yes, I know that's not a word. Work with me here. Anyway, they track the understandability of what Fed chairs say at those post-meeting press conferences they do and that we tell you about. Anyway, Bernanke and Yellen, when they were in charge, gave answers that needed about a 12th grade or early college-ish comprehension level to understand. Powell, eighth grade, maybe freshman year of high school. How about that? I thought that was interesting. Maybe it's because he's not an economist, huh? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.